Dancing in the apocalypse!
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, everybody, and welcome, welcome, welcome to a show that is finally titled, a show you've been waiting to let your ears get rinsed with our voices. It's Maximum Film. I'm your host, Iffy Whiteyway, and in the booth with me are my friends, and I have to introduce you to them, okay? Look, this is the show that was formerly known as Who Shot Ya, the newly titled Maximum Film. If you didn't hear the big news, our new name is Maximum Film. That's why you saw it when you clicked it. This ain't a new podcast. This is the same great show, just a different rapper. As like candy rapper, even not though I do have barbs. Yeah, not Chance the Rapper. Still same great show, just more Maximum. So let's kick this off and introduce you to my friends, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, well, what's good besides our amazing new name, of course, is it's Pride Month, and I am admittedly a little cynical about giant corporations sort of jumping on the bandwagon with their rainbows and stuff. Our guest today has, we've already been talking about this on Facebook, but it's like, you know, if you're a corporation that's been there for the community and, you know, you've been a good steward and a good employer and, you know, back in the lean years, then great, you know, rainbow out all your asses. But like a lot of these other companies, I just don't trust it. Now, I do want to give a shout out, though, to somebody I think is really doing it right, and that would be Hallmark, not the network, the card company. The Hallmark Card Company has for years been super queer inclusive in their stores and their products, and this year I get an email from them every month, and it's always like, you know, Mother's Day, dads and grads, you know, whatever holiday they're pushing. And I get this whole thing about Pride, and I'm like, really, Hallmark? Okay. And I click on the page, and I am taken to one of the best, like, cheat sheets for the American queer civil rights movement in a nutshell that I've ever read. It is, like, very inclusive of trans people and women of color and the people who really fought to make strides. It explains Stonewall. It talks about what life was like, you know, before we had any kind of civil rights protections. They break down what the letters mean in LGBTQIA. I'm like, all right, Hallmark is doing it right. So if you are a big company and you're going to like rainbow me into oblivion, then you need to make your product, if it's not greeting cards, whatever your product is, as relevant to me and as understanding of me and as clearly like, you know, wanting to be, you know, in my corner all 12 months of the year as these cats are doing. So what's good this week? Hallmark fucking cards. That's what.
You know, it's good when Alonzo Duralde is like out here excited about big business. Like, oh, yeah. You know, they've done the work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it is like just a quick thing, but we've seen it time and time again how quickly these businesses will do the lip service, and then, you know, in a few months, you know, queer, black, any like marginalized employees, like, actually on the inside it's been shit.
Yeah, so the people who did the Black Lives Matter like, tweets last year, I was like, yeah,
there's a bunch of politicians we've supported their campaigns for, and like, oh, is that why you don't have an equal rights amendment? Cool, that's great. That's cool.
Thanks for that GIF.
Yeah. Speaking of the gift, this is a gift to all members of the world. When you hear her voice singing from the rooftops, the queen of the Midwest, Drea Clark, what's good?
I appreciate, I meant thanks for the GIF. Like GIF, like GIF. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I just thought it was a really great segue.
Yeah, dang it. Oh, okay. Casey, maybe take that out. What's good with me is in a different direction, but I watched, you know, we don't always talk about a lot of media in the what's good because that's our staff pick. This doesn't really fall in the movie category. It's sort of in between. Bo Burnham's Inside knocked my boots off this week. I am primarily because of my age, which is, of course, ageless. That's what it says on my driver's license. I am not familiar with Bo Burnham in the sort of comedic piano playing guy. I know him as the director of Eighth Grade, a fantastic film from the Sundance Film Festival.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he also, as of course, a co-star in another Sundance film, Promising Young Woman. Like, I know him from this very indie film space. And I found he has a new Netflix special called Bo Burnham's Inside, which he filmed over the pandemic and did everything for. And it's like shot entirely in the sort of guest house that he shares with his partner, Lorraine Scafaria, the director of Hustlers, who I also adore. And I was so impressed by it. I thought the writing of it, it digs into so many interesting things. There's a lot of darkness. A lot of it is his own sort of handling his depression and sort of dark ideations throughout the pandemic, but it's still funny and it's insightful in a lot of interesting ways. Anyway, I found it a really interesting piece of media, you guys. Content, is that what the kids call it? Some real exciting content.
Oh, yes, yeah. Indeed.
Do not start watching it late. Watch it earlier in the day. Watch it while there's some sunshine around.
Ooh, okay.
That's my tip. Yes.
I heard it's there's a lot of oofs in it. So, it's oof.
It's raw. It's got a lot of rawness. Yeah.
Mm. Comedian and writer for Maximum Fun's Troubled Water. My good friend, extremely hilarious, always got something that's going to crack that ass up on the Twitters. It's none other than the wonderful, the illustrious, the amazing Riley Silverman. What's good?
So I think I'm not telling tales out of school when I say that I'm a pretty big Star Wars fan, right? I'm a pretty,
yes.
pretty well-known. So I was out at a bar. There's a bar in Burbank, California called the Burbank Pub that I'm a big fan of. And I'm afraid that by telling the story, I'm going to send a bunch of people there hoping to recreate this story. So I apologize to the Burbank Pub for what's about to happen to you. But I was at the pub and I was there with a nice lady friend, and we were talking about Star Wars. Of course we were. And we'd been talking about Star Wars almost the entire time we were there. And as we were sitting here, a gentleman who I think might be one of the managers or owners or higher ups there walked by, and he goes, "Hey, you guys talking about Star Wars?" And we were like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Light side or dark side?" And I said, "Light side," because light side for life. And then I heard him, and he goes, he just walks away after we said light side. And I thought we'd answered wrong. I mean, right for me, but wrong for him. And then we heard him say, "I'll be right back." And he comes back a minute or two later, and he has these pint glasses that are from the Alamo Drafthouse Mondo collection for Rise of Skywalker, that I guess Alamo had just brought them like cases of these glasses, and they just have them. And so we apparently like passed their test or something. And so, yeah, it was like we got these like free like Rise of Skywalker glass. And I'm like one of the six people who loves Rise of Skywalker. So it was actually like, it has my girl Rey on the front of it right there. Yeah. It's got her lightsaber. So that was a nice little, I guess that's what's good. I don't know if that's like, I was supposed to recommend.
That's a super solid. I mean, what's good.
What makes a night better? If you've already had an enjoyable evening, and then just something that's a surprise, but something that's a surprise that seems from I'm just describing surprises because I was about to say from an unexpected area. You guys, you're welcome. I'm here the whole time for you.
One of those unexpected surprises.
Exactly. But that's wonderful. Like, that would make me glow and just sort of grin the whole ride home.
Iffy, what's good?
What's good with me is, I'm in my robe stage. I'm in my robe stage, and it was.
That's not a euphemism. He is wearing a robe.
Yeah. I'm wearing a satin robe, and it all is from a friend of the pod, Cody Ziegler, sends me a text out of nowhere, and it's like, "You fuck with robes?" And I was like, "I'm not opposed to it." And then he sent me this robe he was looking at, and I was like, "You know what? It is time to achieve my final form of luxury and get a robe." And so I ordered this satin robe. And I get it now. I get it. I've been wearing it all day. I was in the house and like I heard someone was like, "Oh, hey, I fell. And there was like an older lady who fell. And I just, it was so funny because like this big ass black dude like comes out in like a satin robe. And I like helped her up the hill. And she, and I was like, yeah, here you go. You know, yeah, I live in that house. If you ever need anything, let me know. And I was like, she was like, yeah.
If you ever need some Courvoisier and some slow jams.
Thanks, Mrs. Roper.
Yeah, like her, like that was her first time meeting me, so her perception of me is this guy.
I mean, Iffy, that is 100% who you are as a person. Like yeah. You may have just gotten the robe, but this robe is you.
It's been inside you all along.
If she's ever seen your Twitter, this is exactly what you bring to the table.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's
a red satin robe. I love thinking of the person who drove by, saw this, and was furious they couldn't get their phone out in time to take a picture. They spent the whole day texting friends. You are not going to believe what I just saw.
There's no way. There's no way.
The neighbor from a poorly written screenplay is here right now.
Oh, wow. Speaking of gifts, that's the same.
You mean
speaking
the,
of gifts,
the moving pictures that are on the internet?
Yeah. The movie gifts, as in the moving pictures. We're talking about a super big moving picture. Together. And of course, we'll answer a call from the hotline. And we have our staff picks. But first, it's time for our news segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, Is This Important? Do I Care? And first up, we're talking about my man's Neil Gaiman, who is fighting toxic fans over the Sandman casting. There's a live-action Netflix adaptation of the revered comic book series Sandman that is already in the works. And of course, fans of the original comic book series are already upset over the casting of black actress and my friend Kirby Howell Baptiste in the role of Death, who was white in the comic books. And author Neil Gaiman basically spent the entire Memorial Day weekend beating back online trolls with a broom. When one person on Twitter said that Gaiman's sold out and didn't give a fuck about the casting of the new show, Gaiman wrote, I give all the fucks about the work. I spent 30 years successfully battling bad movies of Sandman. I give zero fucks about people who don't understand / haven't read Sandman whining about a non-binary desire or death that isn't white enough. Watch the show and make up your minds. He also said, I'm watching the dailies and the rough cuts, and it's about as Sandman as it could possibly be. And I also want to add one more thing to this. I'm just going to pull it up real quick. I just want to read the intro to Desire real quick. And it's these boxes. There's only one thing to see in the twilight realm of Desire. It is called the Threshold, the Fortress of Desire. Desire has always lived on the edge. The Threshold is larger than you can easily imagine. It's a statue of desire, him, her, or itself. Desire has never been satisfied with just one sex or just one of anything, accepting only perhaps the threshold of itself, meaning that desire is written as non-binary in the source material. Yet you have these mouth-breathing nerds trying to tell the person who write it that he did it wrong. And also it just shows you the state of nerddom that anyone could hop on Twitter and tell Neil Gaiman that he is doing this wrong. Like that to me is so mind-boggling, idiotic, that it's like, oh, you really like you know, we call you dumb, but you really are dumb.
Wait, ask the question.
Oh, is this
I
important?
I just want to tag
care?
In. Thank you. No, I'm glad you shared that. And I do think it's like that is the equivalent of all of those people who love to respond to something to the person who is the source material, who will do that like about legislation and say like, this bill is not in the, it'll be like a congressperson who says, I wrote the bill, I'm aware. And there is, I'm regularly amazed in the smaller amount of time I spend on Twitter or in any social media space that I don't think of most humans as confident, and yet the confidence that people will say the dumbest shit, like, it is truly, just use that energy in better ways in your life.
Dave always likes to say the worst thing that ever happened to fans is when they thought that they had a say. You know, and so this is that, it's just so writ large. But my favorite headline to come out of all of this was, Neil Gaiman defends casting a non-binary actor to play a non-binary character.
Another thing, like, they were mad because this is why I don't think people are even really fans of the work per se, because like they saw that Jenna Coleman is playing Joanna Constantine and they were like, oh, you gender swapped Constantine, you're just messing with it. No, Joanna Constantine is literally the great grandmother of John Constantine. Like, she's playing ancestor of the character. They were all up in arms. She's like an existing character in the canon, and that's who she's playing. But people were just, they just saw the name Constantine. They don't know the source material, and they're just yelling at him for it. But I think it's important also because I feel like there's a lot of push with social media in to not respond to negative fan backlash and to kind of like, we've seen people who've gotten fired from writing gigs or have had their like they've been like asked to stop responding to toxicity in social media. And I think it's really great that Gaiman has the kind of influence and privilege that he can step up and be like, no, we're not going to, I'm not letting this happen. I'm not going to let you all just be racist and transphobic and sexist on this feed about my project. I'm going to tear you down for it. And I love that. That's why I think it's important and why I care about it, because it's so rare that a creator has this kind of freedom to do it. I think it's really great that it happens because of that, because I think it's great that a creator has the privilege and the role to do that.
All right. Speaking of feelings, it's the closest I can get to a good segue, y'all. This is an article that we found. It was published in October, but we all recently read it, and I think it's pretty interesting and has a lot of bits in it that is stuff that we cover. So we're going to get into it. It's still news. It's news whenever we say it's news.
That's right.
So thanks, Alonzo. Last October, writer Nicole Johnson wrote an essay in National Geographic called How Horror Movies Can Help People Overcome Real-World Trauma. She cites the work of Matthias Claussen, the director of the Recreational Fear Lab and an associate professor in literature and media at Aarhus University in Denmark, who says that, quote, controlled fear experiences such as watching horror movies may have a positive effects in terms of fine-tuning coping strategies. Johnson also cites a recent study that shows that horror fans are faring much better psychologically than non-fans during the emotionally draining months of the COVID-19 pandemic. Johnson's article also discusses that the viewer going through these, quote, controlled fear experiences is in the safety of their own living room, which allows them to be more resilient to other traumatic events. Is this important? Do you care?
Yeah. I care in that I think it's interesting that I'm not a horror fan, but what I've always sort of observed as one of the appealing things about horror is that it takes you to terrible places and things that you maybe never wanted to contemplate in your life, and then it resolves them. You know, whether it ends well or badly for the heroes, at least it does reach an endpoint, which so many real life horrors don't necessarily, or don't in a way that we can appreciate or that we get to see happen. So I understand the cathartic value of a terrible thing that is also a contained thing.
What I would say about it is that I'm working on a project right now that involves monsters and fear. And we did a lot of research into where monsters come from in culture. And I went through a deep dive in where like queerness overlaps with monsters and depictions, because I was thinking about how villains in media are often queer coded, especially in like older Disney films and things like that. But what I found really fascinating, this is a little bit of a sidestep from the original article, but it's what it made me think of immediately, is what I found out when reading this article, when I was researching this aspect, and there was a book about like queer voices and monsters in old Hollywood cinema and old horror films and monster films, is that a lot of the queer coding of monsters is not intended to be like, oh, queer people are meant to be, you're supposed to be afraid of them and they're bad, that's why they're villains. It was just, that was how queer voices in early cinema were able to subvert and get our voices into the story and into the tale. And that's why so many villain stories also, there is elements of the fear of the unknown that kind of came in later generations, but and I guess that's why it's relevant to me right now, because I was thinking about the other day when people were starting to get so upset that Cruella was coming out and they were real mad about it on the internet. And I finally tweeted that I don't care about any straight people's opinions on Cruella at all, because I said that Disney villains are Disney princesses for gay kids. And so I think, and actually when I watched Cruella, I was like, this is basically a secret trans story. So I was very into it. So it's a little bit of a sidestep from what the actual piece was about, but it was written in October, so I've had time to think about it, right? So that's that's how I thought about it. With it being Pride Month, with a villain movie having just come out, and this idea that I've just recently studied about the way that monsters in horror were queer-coded, it all kind of like came together with reading this piece a little bit. So it's a way of expressing trauma and history and stuff like that.
Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Together Together.
Hey, everybody, we'll be back to Maximum Film. Still getting used to saying that in a second. But first, here's a message from our friends at Storyblocks. Storyblocks is dedicated to being the world's best royalty-free stock media subscription service with an ever-growing library that has more than 1 million high-quality stock assets, including 4K HD footage, After Effects, and Premiere Pro templates, music, images, sound effects, and more.
That is right, Alonzo. They have affordable subscription plans and tools, and with Storyblocks' unlimited all-access plan, you can get unlimited downloads of everything in their library. And even if your subscription ends, everything you've downloaded is yours to keep. And as part of an ongoing restock initiative, Storyblocks has released a new round of collections, Queer Spaces and Faces, created by some really incredible LGBTQI plus creators that will feature the layered experiences of the LGBTQI plus community.
So this is producer Casey here, and I'm just jumping in because I actually used Storyblocks several times this past week.
Testify!
Yes, I used it in our video to announce our new name. I used some of the stock music in there. They've got tons of great royalty-free music that you can put in your video, because that's always an issue when you're like, I need this video to sound really good and professional, but I need music. Where do I get? I don't have money to pay a composer. That sounds outrageous. But with Storyblocks, you can get, there's a bunch of great royalty-free music on there. And it's just a great service, and I found it really useful for this very show this week.
Oh, bringing it home.
So, look, if that all sounds exciting to you, you can explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/WhoShot. We're going to get the new one in there soon, don't you worry. But for now, that's storyblocks.com/WHOSHOT. And that's the T, sis.
Oh, my God.
Does our podcast deep dive into the weirdest Wikipedia pages we can find?
Yes. Do we learn about scam artists, remote islands, horrible mascots, beautiful diseases, and mythical monsters?
Yes, 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 absolutely, and yes. Do we retain any of this knowledge?
Probably not. I'm Emily Heller.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
We make art and comedy and TV shows and also the podcast Baby Geniuses. For the past 8 years, we've been trying to learn new things about the world and each other every episode.
But let's be honest, this podcast is mostly about two friends hanging out, shooting the breeze, and making each other laugh. We're horny, we like gardening and horses, and we get real stupid on here.
But like, in a smart way.
Yeah.
Join us every other week on Maximum Fun.
Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Riley Silverman.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about Together Together. Alonzo, would you mind providing us with a brief synopsis?
Sure. Together Together is about a young woman who is goes to work or agrees to be a surrogate mother for a single Silicon Valley, you know, rich person who decides that he wants to be a parent, even though he isn't in a relationship. And over the course of the pregnancy, as much as he tries to respect her personal space, he's also like can't help micromanaging every aspect of the pregnancy. And the more time they spend together, the closer they become, but not in the sort of traditional three-act structure of a rom-com. But nonetheless, they do grow together as this friendship. And, you know, we're sort of left to wonder how much or how little she will remain in his life after the child is born. But clearly, they have had an impact on each other's lives no matter what.
Yes, indeedy. I mean, to kick things off, this movie feels like, this film feels like, this Maximum Film feels like it has the blueprints for a nice, cute romantic comedy, but it doesn't end in romance. So how does this movie use the rom-com tropes in a new way?
I was just picturing, like, if J-Lo were in this movie. You know,
yes,
we know exactly what that would look like.
Yeah. J-Lo and Matthew McConaughey. Well, the difference right there is, so this is, it's Ed Helms and Patty Harrison, and he's a good 20 years older than her. And so there were so many surprises for me as I watched this, because, like, if he said, when it starts out, like, you sort of see them and they're on this kind of date interview thing, you know how first dates can kind of be like that anyway, and you're like, oh, well, he's pretty methodical in these questions.
Yeah.
But he's actually trying to get a little awareness of her because he's talking to her as a potential surrogate, and how it changes in the idea of them growing this platonic relationship between a man and a woman that's not trying to do the When Harry Met Sally, like, can men and women ever be friends? And this is like, well, friendship has so many colors and textures and layers, and it's so different depending on the relationship. And then the uniqueness of this scenario as well. Like, there were so many things I thought were lovely in this. I loved the idea of a single man in his 40s who really wanted to be a dad. And, you know, we see a lot of movies centered around women where motherhood is this thing they want to attain, and, like, oh, either society or money or the relationship, like, all these things are keeping them. And we don't explore that a lot with men. And so that was another element that, like, there were so many little ways that this subverted what I was expecting, both in his character and her character and the dynamic between them. And I thought it was, but it was still, it was doing it in ways that I, you know, you recognize all these scenes. Like, there's the scene where she meets the people at the, oh, you guys, I just almost called it a birthing party. A shower, a baby shower. Oh my God, I call myself an ageless woman. Ugh. A baby shower. That's, you know, like, there's these things that you're like, oh, this, I bet, is when this is going to happen. Or, oh, they're going to stay up late and paint this room. I wonder if they're going to get intimate. And they do get intimate. They just don't get sexy with each other.
I think also this movie, in like so many romantic comedies, like, Nora Ephron gets a bad rap for this, but everybody does it to one extent or other. This is a comfortable world. He is wealthy. She is, even though she's working class, like, has a cool, funky apartment, you know, in San Francisco. Because, you know, those cool, funky apartments are just everywhere and everybody can afford them. It's, you know, so this is a movie that has clearly been sort of like art directed in a very Sunday brunch kind of way, and that's fine, and I like that. That adds to the coziness factor of movies like this, and so I think they're definitely sort of playing around with that idea and kind of goofing on the fact that, yeah, he does represent the reason why no one can live in San Francisco anymore is because all these tech assholes with money have all the houses.
Also, something I feel like you were touching on earlier, Drea, is, like, yeah, if this movie would have went and they had a romantic connection, just because of the way movies are marketed, you know, towards us, I wouldn't have saw anything wrong. And that's what I appreciate the fun in, where the movie goes hella meta and explains this age gap, why it's wrong, and then takes a second to remind us why Woody Allen is trash, like, beat for beat. It's so interesting.
They literally discuss Woody Allen. Yeah.
And why his, like, greatest works, quote unquote, are actually themselves, like, him justifying his relationships as opposed to actually being, like, legitimate, just, like, love stories. They're, like, they're all him trying to, like, claim this part of himself.
And, you know, I have to say, like, I'm realizing that Ed Helms is one of those people who, he doesn't do it on the level of somebody like Nicole Kidman, who will make, like, some, you know, like a Lars von Trier movie and then Bewitched, you know. But he definitely, you can tell his one for thems versus his one for me's, you know. I, like, if you've endured, like, We're the Millers or the Vacation remake, it's like, all right, this is Ed Helms getting paid. But then if you watch, like, Cedar Rapids or a movie like this, you know, it's like, oh, okay, you really can act and you really have this fascinating on-screen persona. Like, you know, I think when I interviewed Cedar Rapids, like, I was reminded of Harold Lloyd. Like, he has this, he can take these kind of characters who would just seem like, oh, nebbishy, whatever, and really just find all these layers in there. And I think we're seeing him do that here. And then you have, you know, Patty Harrison, who I think is a brilliant comic performer. I loved her on Shrill. And you know, I had no idea that she had it in her to do a performance that is this, like, yes, it's deadpan, but there is genuine sentiment and emotion in it as well. And like, she can carry a movie. And so, like, that's a short list of people, I think. And I hope that this movie, if it gets seen more, I think has the potential to do for her, like, what Girls Trip did for Tiffany Haddish. You know, it's like, hey, here's this amazing resource that you haven't been paying enough attention to, and she can do it all, and let's let her do it all.
She's an interesting combination of, like, a lot of deadpan. The whole idea there is you're, like, locking out emotion. And yet what we need from this character in Together is she is a quiet character. And there's moments where we need to be able to read so much off of her. And not a spoiler, but there's a birthing scene in this movie about surrogacy.
And not at the birthing party, though.
Not at the birthing party. You guys, you know, just a standard traditional American birthing party. But the birthing scene, what she's giving in that moment is so emotionally wrought and deep. Yeah, she does a wonderful job. And there's not a lot of people who can do that. And the comedy of it.
Yeah, as someone who witnessed an actual live birth, it was goddamn accurate. One thing I also really like about this movie is the way it explores, you know, boundaries. As someone, you know, who is all about, you know, being upfront in boundaries and dating and in friendships, it really kind of goes, like, you can almost look at the rules of the surrogacy to look at these, like, these, like, believed institutions. Like, for example, you know, people have assumed that this idea of monogamy is this same accepted one that we see on TV when it's different from person to person, or what makes a friend goes person to person. You have friends who don't want to be your therapist. You have friends who do want to be your therapist. There's so many, and especially because Twitter can be so binary, everyone wants to assume there's a right or wrong way, when really it's all about the boundaries that go from person to person. And you kind of see that where at the beginning, they're trying to follow you have Ed Helms trying to follow the rules and make sure everything's right. And she's kind of feeling more comfortable, and there creates this disconnect until they find that they are more comfortable together, finding their own boundaries that work for them. And then when she gets a little discomfort, when she kind of sees how the rest of his family treats her as this, you know, as this, like, not even a person, just this receptacle for the child. And then she leans back on those previous boundaries, and then they're unable to find until they truly admit between the both of them that, like, what they really want, and that they do love each other, even though it is a surrogacy. And it's really, I think, beautiful. And that's, like, one of my favorite parts of this.
I really liked how the entirety of their relationship that we see depicted on the film takes place within the bounds of the surrogacy. Like, there are moments where you kind of get the implication of, like, what their lives are going to be like afterwards, but we don't ever see it. Yeah. We meet them when they meet each other at the meeting to see if she's going to be the surrogate. And then we kind of cut ahead real quickly to, like, when they're like starting to take hold and stuff like that. And then it ends with the delivery, and there's nothing after that. It's cut to black, cut to credits, and every single thing else outside of this surrogacy is unspoken in the film, and not in a way that, like, leaves you like, oh, it's a set. Like, you can depict it a lot of ways. Like, I rewatched the ending a couple of times to see how I felt about it. So I'm like, oh, there's a really sad reading of this ending. And it's, again, to go back to Alonzo's point about this, I think a lot of the reason why I got such a sad ending for it is because there is so much emotion in Patty's face during, there's a very long sustained close-up on her face. And that affected me very much personally in a way that we'll get into, I think, in a little bit when we talk about other parts of this movie. But I very much was like, oh, is this a tragic ending in a way? But I also think you can still read it in a happy way, but it's left very ambiguous, and it's not left as, like, we're telling you the story of the rest of their lives, as opposed to we're telling you how these two people existed with each other for this 9 months, and then whatever else happens, you can figure out for yourselves.
I think the other thing, and certainly we discussed this off air. I was just going to say off air. But there's also the uniqueness of casting Patty Harrison, and I'd love to discuss that, because for anyone not familiar with her, she is a trans actress, comedian, and very clearly, because we're talking about the surrogacy, was cast in this straight up cisgendered role. And it's something that I'm sure, and it's part of the conversation of it, that I'm sure many people watching were probably oblivious to any kind of her background if she was new to them. But it was also something I've been familiar with Patty for years. I remember when she was on The Daily Show. And so I was so delighted. Delighted's a weird word for it, but I had a weird kind of happiness in seeing her in this role, and the idea of either the casting director, the producers, the director, whatever it was, that was like, oh, well, you know, when we talk about broadening and finding the best person for it, this is the best person we think for it. But there's all sorts of complications that come with that. So I would certainly love to hear everyone else's thoughts.
It's really complicated for me because I actually wrote a piece a couple of years ago about the way that we cast for films with trans voices and characters, and how I think this movie is like the extreme of what I was kind of talking about, because I feel like I've been called in for auditions where the character is written as trans, and I will be in a room full of people who could not be less like me, or we're such dramatically different types. And I'm like, well, who is this character then? If you have no idea what you're looking for the, like, and the only way I can describe it is if we were all cis women, we would never be caught in for the same role together. But because the role says trans, we're all there together. And it's ridiculous that we'll be listed together on this role. And I always say, like, hey, just bring in trans actors to play characters. And like, if unless your character is explicitly written as trans because it's important to the story, like, you don't need to only bring me. And I always say, like, I can play a nosy, weird neighbor on a Parks and Rec style show. Like, I can play the weird person in a Michael Schur comedy who, like, makes the main character's life harder for an episode more than I think I could play most trans characters. But then usually that kind of boils down to, should trans actors be cast as cis roles? And I normally say, what if you stop thinking about roles as cis or trans and you think of roles as bus driver or doctor or lawyer or whatever? And like, and I always say, like, unless the script explicitly calls for the character to be cis, like if it's someone's mother or in this case, a surrogate, like, don't think about it. But in this case, they did exactly that. And I do think that there is probably a longer conversation than we have time for on this show to get into about the way that, like, if we take out talent as a determining factor, I would never be cast to play this role the way that Patty would be, because I will never be convincingly, like, no one who doesn't know that I'm trans would not know that I was trans the second I appeared on screen. So if I was cast in this role and I had the level of talent that Patty has, the second I was on screen, they go, this person can't carry a child. What's wrong with you? Like, that would be like, it would be a suspension of disbelief that would take them out of the film immediately. Whereas, like, Patty does have that level of mainstream attractiveness that allows her to be able to play a part like that. But at the same time, does have the skills and the talent to back it up to the point where, so that kind of thing, that's all in my head when I'm watching this, right? And I'm like fascinated that she is actually able to do it. And I'm so happy and excited the same way you said that you were. But I will say that I also unexpectedly, while watching this movie, broke down into some pretty severe dysphoric tears by the end of it, because motherhood and fertility are things that I have some pretty big dysphoric triggers with. I remember years ago being at the farmer's market with a friend of mine, and she just kind of like casually we were talking about trying to have kids, whatever. And she goes, do you want to have kids? And I just started sobbing because I had recently like going through a process of like having to decide not to pursue certain things because of my hormone treatments. So like it was in the back of my head and it hasn't really come up in a long time, but then it did. So this moment when Patty Harrison is playing a woman who is giving birth and has these tears and is going through these emotions, and it feels very real. Even prior to that, when she's talking about having already had a child in the movie and the motherhood element, it was a lot for me in ways that I did not expect it to be when going into the movie, to where like I almost want to like tell, if you're a trans person watching this and you have triggers about fertility and maternity, trigger warning, heavy, heavy trigger warning. Because I even posted it on my Facebook, like, I did not expect this to give me as much feels as it did. And two other trans women responded with the same exact, like, yes, I didn't expect it either. And it really hit me hard. So it was a really fun. I think I jumped around about six topics there in that paragraph. So I apologize. But
those were great topics.
A lot of things happening there.
I'll say to sort of what you were mentioning, Riley, that I didn't see, and maybe if Alonzo or if he had caught any of this, I didn't see any of the press around this mentioning Patty being a trans actor, and which, fair enough. I mean, I also applaud that. There is something really beautiful about just having it be about her role, especially in such a breakout role. But then there is also this whole other avenue of, I wonder if she has spoken about anything this might have brought up in herself. Because we get so many, you know, insightful things from actors and performers of what they go through with characters. Yeah. And this is such a unique and specific thing that might be helpful to someone else. If not, good on her if she doesn't want to say anything to
you. I do wonder if filming this film would have been cathartic for me or would have been traumatic for me. Or maybe maybe back to our topic earlier about horror films and catharsis and trauma. Like, sure. It might have been kind of a mix of the two.
Okay, yeah, it's time for us to vote. I've beat the buzzer, but I think we've said a lot of great things. So for our final review of Together, would you snap it up on physical media, stream it, or skip it? We'll start with you, Riley.
I think stream it. I think people should check it out. I think that, I think it's a good rental, good digital rental, or a good check it out when it's on a stream.
I really, really enjoy this film. I'd say snap it up on physical media only because that still exists as our see it in a theater, screen it kind of option. I think there's something really special, like very low key special about this. Snap it up.
I would snap it up as well, mainly for a Patty Harrison commentary track. I think that would be rich. I like this film a lot. I think it's really charming. It's really funny. I love the writing. I love the acting. I hope that people are seeking it out. I worry that it's the kind of film that, you know, like makes a small festival splash and then sort of falls between the cracks. But, you know, yeah, go see this thing.
There's a lot of deceptively hilarious, like, you don't expect really funny lines in a movie like this. And there were some that, like, made me cackle, like random lines.
You know, this is a snap it up for me. I cried at so many. It was different levels of shit that was making me cry. It was wild. I had the meta cry when they were crying during Friends. I was crying with You're the Best. And then I was crying in the birth scene because it reminded me of when my daughter was born. And like that feeling of when you hear those tears, it just took me back. Just top to bottom was waterworks. So... We'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Are you feeling elevated levels of anxiety? Do you quake uncontrollably, even thinking about watching cable news? Do you have disturbing nightmares, only to realize it's 2 in the afternoon and you're up? If you've experienced one or more of these symptoms, you may have FNO, news overload. Fortunately, there's treatment. Hi, I'm Dave Holmes, host of Troubled Waters. Troubled Waters helps fight FNO. That's because Troubled Waters stimulates your joy zone. On Troubled Waters, two comedians will battle one another for pop culture supremacy. So join me, Dave Holmes, for 2 doses of Troubled Waters a month. The cure for your news overload. Available on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Riley Silverman,
Drea Clark.
And today we have an email sent to our hotline from Emma. Emma writes, as a graphic designer, I love seeing really great graphic design in movies, including period-specific props, stellar opening credit sequences, and much more rarely, actual mentions of graphic design in the film. Hello, American Psycho. What are your favorite examples of graphic design in movies? Do any opening credits or title cards stick out to you? Mine include any Saul Bass opening credits and the title card for Rosemary's Baby.
I love this question so much, y'all.
Yeah, it's a good question.
It's so good. Right. There's, and if you don't know, this is just a slice of it, but South by Southwest always does a poster design competition along with the festival, which I love because we don't credit that kind of thing. And the first thing that comes to mind for me is the graphic design in Wes Anderson films.
Sure.
Is so impeccable, so highly stylized. And he generally works with a graphic designer named Annie Atkins. And so she, like, just looking just at, like, the Grand Budapest Hotel, it's the opening sequence, but it's everything. She does the typography, those pink boxes that the suites all came in, newspapers, telegraphs. There's so much in there that, and graphic design is the kind of thing that, because it's sort of an art form within an art form in film, you shouldn't really notice it, because if you're noticing it, then it's standing out, unless it's meant to be like some sort of clever whatever, or, but it's such a great way to enhance a story. And Wes Anderson is obviously someone who very definitely embraces and integrates it from, like, the word go.
Even though in a Wes Anderson movie I don't like, I will enjoy looking at, you know, like in the Darjeeling Limited, I was there for the towels and the luggage. And they did not disappoint. I agree that Saul Bass obviously is the king of this sort of thing with his legendary run of opening credits and poster designs for, you know, for Hitchcock and Otto Preminger and quite a few other filmmakers. I also want to give a shout out to Maurice Binder, who is best known for his, he did a lot of the early 007 credit sequences.
I was going to say, the Bond ones are
all of those. Synonymous. So, all of those women sort of swimming around or doing somersaults or whatever in silhouette like that. That's all him. But he also did, like, quite a few Stanley Donen movies, including Charade and Arabesque and Two for the Road.
Two for the Road, a film you so rarely mention.
Yes, that's that one. I've become a big fan of his work on credits as well. But yeah, Saul Bass is always and forever the king.
If you are listening and not familiar with Saul Bass, Please look him up, because you will automatically be like, with Saul Bass, because he did so much work with, like, Hitchcock and, like, the Psycho credits and design, and Vertigo. Anatomy of a Murder I always loved with it's a sort of like a chalk outline of a body.
Man with the golden arm.
Yeah, the James Bond, the whole thing of James Bond is they love a good opening sequence. And I think it's Skyfall that had one of my favorites is this Adele track. And I think it's Daniel Kleinman was the designer of it. And it integrates all of the sort of bodies in water and all the things with shadow, like all of the stuff you would think of in a Bond.
I think Adele design. Was the first person, actually the first of the singers of the Bond themes to be in the credits.
Ooh.
If I remember that correctly, I think that Adele in Skyfall was the first one to be featured.
Seems like a good trivia question we should all lock away for later.
I do want to apologize to Film Twitter. There is some obscure indie movie that barely made its way off of the festival circuit in the late 90s. And I don't remember anything about the movie. I can barely remember the title is like what it's like one short word, but the opening credits were dazzling. And I thought they were so amazing. And I was trying, I asked Film Twitter this week because I was going to, who's going to answer this question, what movie I was thinking of, and no one could come up with it. And we're all very frustrated about that. So if it ever pops up, I'll bring it up. But I do love, like, comedic caper movies that have animated opening credits. It's like that is my catnip.
Yeah, I think for me it comes back to when I was a kid and I kept getting tricked that I thought Pink Panther was an actual Pink Panther cartoon because the opening credits had the Pink Panther cartoon stuff in it.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah.
I think my answer to the question, the one that popped into my head immediately when I read the question, was the movie Thank You for Smoking by Jason Reitman. Am I putting the right one in there? Yeah.
Yeah, Jesse Randall.
Yeah, I couldn't remember who did the... I'm looking on IMDb trying to figure out who actually did the credit sequence, and I can't figure out which job did it. But I remember it always sticks in my head because it's all everyone's name in the form of old cigarette packages and like user warnings and stuff like that. And it's really cleverly done. And I'm always a really big... And it has like this old-fashioned like kind of like old country cowboy type song playing over it, and like it's like a song about smoking cigarettes, and then you have this like really bouncy boopy thing. It's like brightly colored, it's gorgeous. So that was what jumped in my head immediately, and that's why it's not. I also love, this is such a much more pedestrian thing to say after that, but I do love, I think it's Kong Skull Island, where the opening credits are all like redacted government documents that are being put up as it goes on.
Yeah. Right.
I'm always a fan of when they actually like incorporate some element of the movie's story or like tone into the opening credits. Yeah. So that's a pretty mainstream version of it, but I remember really loving that effect. And
they're done really well.
That is a good one.
The last one that comes to mind for me is, and it's sort of, it feels like the cousin of a Wes Anderson, is Jared Hess's Gentleman Broncos, which was his follow-up to Napoleon Dynamite. And the whole thing of it, every single credit...
Oh,
sorry, there's a dog going crazy near me. But every single credit, they did a different design of like a sci-fi book.
Yeah.
So they're these really great like octopus lifting the words up or whatever. And they're so... Like that. It's just one of those that you're like, ooh... I want my name drawn in one of those.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention Pedro Almodovar.
Of course. probably fined.
Exactly. Yeah. His credits, but also like just his the general sense of design in his films is always, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a sucker for any of the like old like 80s horror movie pulp kind of covers. Like I remember before I saw... second of Stranger Things, the TV series. Like, I remember just driving in LA and seeing that giant poster and just like that image of like people jumping out of the frame and the title. Like, I was like, that's for me. Like, whatever that is. Like, I hope the show is as good as that is, because it were just that's me there. That's for me.
Yeah.
Well, they made me something.
Yeah. Awesome. Kids on bike jumping out of a thing. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you to everyone who has submitted a question. The number for the hotline is 979-803-1664. Or if you want to send us an email, write to us at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Now it is time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. So, Alonzo, why don't you start?
So this is a film that I actually helped program at Outfest, I want to say 2 years ago. It is now making its debut on Hulu. It's a documentary called Changing the Game, and it is a look at the very hot button topic of high school athletes who are trans, who want to compete, in their correct gender, and are having to deal with, bureaucracies and people who are just making their lives generally difficult. They focus on three: a male wrestler from Texas, a female skier from New Hampshire, and
a track runner.
Thank you. Yes, from Connecticut, and I think the movie really just explores a lot of interesting issues. Lets these athletes sort of speak for themselves and explain why, like, this is perfectly logical that they should be able to compete, and the sort of frothing insanity of the people who are constantly getting in their way. I because I never review movies that I do with Outfest, I had our critic Dan Callahan write about it, and he pointed out something that I think is really great about the film, which is that it is a film that isn't just preaching to the choir. Like, this is a movie that you could show to somebody who maybe doesn't understand the issues, who's maybe ambivalent about the idea of like, oh, well, I mean, is it unfair? And I think by the end of the film, they'd be like, ah, okay, I see why this makes sense.
I will back up and support and high five that choice, Alonzo.
Thank you.
Good
Super
job.
Super relevant now, too, especially with all the different state bills that are happening.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. For sure.
Definitely, sadly.
Sadly,
relevant.
More relevant, even than when we did it a couple of years ago. Like, it's gotten worse because it's an easy hot button thing for people to fearmonger over.
Ugh. Okay. My staff pick. I'll go, Iffy. I won't even let you call on me.
Oh, yeah. I was just getting ready. My lips were quivering and moist.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you for that. For sure. He again is wearing a red satin robe. I think that detail is crucial.
Context is everything.
Yeah. Mine is a film that, I'm going to double check where it is. It's on currently on Hulu called Plan B that's directed by Natalie Morales, who is an actress that many people might recognize. It is fantastic. It is about two teenage girls. It has that kind of all one night teenage girl hijink party, whatever. And then they're the sort of teenage good girls. You get a little book smart thing. And one of them hooks up, and then the majority of it is spent the next day of them driving around, trying desperately to get a morning after pill. And again, it's one of these great comedies that takes on some, that's a big thing. It has weird similarities to Never Rarely Sometimes Always. But it could not be more different, because it is hysterical. It is sex positive, queer positive, body positive. It's all sorts of stuff. It's also genuinely hilarious. The two leads are fantastic. And I encourage people to check it out. It's a great watch. Great, great fun watch, guys.
Ooh, okay. Riley, do you have a staff pick for us?
I think I do. And I have the least queer pick, I think, out of this group so far. I leaned more towards an older movie that is a charming movie about pregnancy. And I came up recently in a conversation on Twitter of what's a movie that you really love that you feel like nobody else has seen or nobody else knows. And I brought it up, and only like a handful of people like, I love this movie. And it's this movie called Away We Go, starring John Krasinski and Maya Rudolph. And it is this very, very, it's exactly a very charming indie darling film, a pleasant world about pregnancy. And it's Krasinski, and it is Maya Rudolph. And the premise of the film is that they are a young couple that are expecting, and for reasons that the movie gets into, they can no longer live. Well, they're his parents are moving away, so they're not going to live by them. And so now they're traveling the world looking for a place to live and raise their child. And so it's a series of like vignettes as they go from city to city, and they have like very charming interactions with lots of people that you love, like Allison Janney and Jim Gaffigan. There is one section that I will give a trigger warning if you are someone who is triggered by child loss or miscarriage. There is one of the vignettes does deal with that in a way that is very beautifully, It is a heartbreaking performance, and it's an actress that I love, Melanie Lynskey. And in this scene, she has no dialogue, and it's a scene that I still to this day think she was robbed of an Oscar nom for, because there was just so much going on with her face in this scene. It is strangely a movie directed by Sam Mendes that most people seem to never have heard of. I don't know. It's very strange. It was written by Dave Eggers and Vendela Vida, and it's just very pleasant. It's very kind and sweet, and it's one that popped in my head because I think because of the movie we watched today.
Maya
it's
Rudolph available also on, should have gotten an Oscar nomination for that
100%.
Movie.
Yeah.
So great.
It is available right now, I believe, on Peacock with an ads. So I don't know. I mean, you could rent it other places, but if you're looking for a non-fee-based system, that's where it's
nice.
At. So I really enjoy it. It's a very sweet movie, and I recommend it.
I double thumbs up that one too. Iffy. Yes, yeah. Iffy.
Hey, woo. What's up? It's your boy. And, you know, now that I've got my schedule under wraps, we're getting back to my usual. This is my usual type of staff pick where, you know, instead of just doing something based on the movie, I just say a movie I saw in hopes that it would be my staff picks. And sometimes it ain't. Well, I mean, it is, but I don't know how hard of a sell I'm gonna give you. I saw 2007 Sunshine, which was a Danny Boyle joint. You know, you got a young tight Chris Evans. You got Cillian Murphy giving Crispin Glover vibes. You got Rose Byrne looking very snackish. So does Michelle Yeoh. But the movie itself kind of meanders a bit. Yeah, you're my staff pick.
Here's a pick of a thing not to watch.
Yeah, I've done a few staff picks like that where I watch a movie thinking like, this is going to be my staff pick movie. I'm going to watch it. And then it finishes and I go, there's no way I can't explain why this is on my staff pick, but why you should also not judge me when you watch it.
I've never seen that movie because I want to see it projected. I hear it's like really incredible on the big screen. So yes, like I've still never seen Sunshine.
That is true. It looks amazing, but the story, if I know you like I know you, Alonzo, you will come out disappointed.
But you know what? Even in Los Angeles, nobody ever programs Sunshine in repertory.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now it's time for the 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review, we'll read it on the air. Okay? Check this out. I started listening mid-teen, shout out to Using Teen, last June 2020, and I was hooked from the first pod. Y'all quickly became my favorite pod. Sorry, Savage Lovecast, but you had a good 12-year run. Got him! It took me a while to adjust to Iffy, as I was a huge Ricky. Okay, I was like, wait, I was too horny. As I was a huge Ricky Carmona fan, but now I listen to his corn cinema, and I've come to love Iffy's sexy ew when when reacting to whatever Drea and Alonzo happen to be hyping. Love this podcast. You're talking about my ooh. Okay, I got it. I'm listening to it for the second time in a row. Best ever was the Fast Cast 4-episode series inspired me to watch the saga while I had Rona during Christmas, New Year's 2021. Thank you for surviving Rona and thinking the first thing you should do after having Rona was leave that 5-star review. This was from your Maestro 3000. Thank you so much. Oh,
there's a postscript.
There's a postscript. I have bought Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas on Amazon.
Yay.
I was disappointed to receive a used copy. Ooh. I hope Alonzo got some dollars for that transaction.
I do too. But yeah. I appreciate the thought either way, Maestro.
Yes.
Riley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yay, Riley. Thanks for being here.
Is there anything you'd like to plug?
I mentioned earlier I was working on a project about monsters. I'm part of an all-female improv comedy collective group called Ripley Improv, and we are doing a show right now every Friday night. We started it in May. We're doing it all the way through the rest of June called Slay. It's every Friday at 6 p.m. Pacific time. You can find that on twitch.tv/Ripley Improv, or you can watch all the previous episodes so far on that Twitch channel or on the Ripley Improv YouTube page. And the premise of the show is that we are a group of monster hunters. It's an entirely improvised show, and it's done. We actually created the show. It's created by Aliza Pearl. It's fantastic. She created the show specifically for online streaming and as a Twitch show. So we're all doing monologues, and she kind of hands the monologues off to, like, we're doing like a series of monologues to her. As like she's a profiler and we're agents have been hunting monsters. And over the course of each episode, we collectively build a monster while also telling stories about our characters and what we've been through. So it's a very narrative driven monologue story based podcast. I mean, our show, it's very live theater show, and it's very fun to do. It's very exciting. And we've had a lot of really fun episodes with it so far. So there's a few more weeks left in June to check that out. And also, real quick, I'm in a movie that's coming out this month. It's called Too Late, and it's released by Gravitas Pictures. It'll be available on VOD and I think in some theatrical spaces on June 25th. So I play a very hilarious stand-up comedian named Riley Silverman. And I'm in it, but I actually end up seeing the film. It's delightful. It's got a lot of really good, fun, lovely people in it. And so I recommend checking it out.
With that, all I have to say is if you have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is the wonderful Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
Subtle bird on Casey.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.